This is a CBC podcast.
Support for delivery of this podcast comes from Chevrolet. At Chevrolet, we bring people together with the things that matter to them most. Visit chevrolet.gm.ca.
Welcome to the Between the Covers podcast. I'm Heather Brown. This week, we're listening to Jane Urquhart's novel, The Stone Carvers. In the last installment, we saw Clara Becker at two different times in her life. As a young woman, Clara is frustrated with Eamon O'Sullivan as he sits silent in her kitchen night after night. And in a flashback to her childhood, the little girl Clara watched as her brother Tillman's hunger for freedom drove their parents to a desperate act. In this episode, young Clara faces a difficult decision about her brother. And for the older Clara, Eamon finally breaks his silence.
Dieter, unable to bear the sight of Tillman straining at the end of his chain, or the sound of his cries, left the house before dawn and returned to it in darkness when he hoped all were asleep. On the fourth night, something growled at him when he crossed the yard, and he realized that Tillman had not gone indoors to sleep, though the season was well enough advanced that there was a hard frost on the ground. Dieter sat down on the stoop beside the curled form that his son made in the dark. He tried to touch Tillman's shoulder, but the boy twitched away from him. "Tillman," he began, "your mother is half mad with worry about you, and me too, wondering what will become of you if you go off again. Would you give me your word that you'll stay?" The boy began to whimper. His father continued, "How will you look after yourself? How will you learn to be a man?" His father put his head in his hands and after a few moments looked up at the stars. "You see," he said to the boy, "we are all tied to a place." He coughed into his hand. "We're stuck to it. What if I were just to up and leave? What if I were just to wander off? Then who would keep the fields?" "There's fields everywhere," said Tillman quietly. "And everywhere," said his father, "there's a man keeping them." The boy said nothing more. The next morning, Tillman's howling started at the same moment as the birds began to sing, at the first suggestion of light. His cries were taken up by dogs all over the county, a kind of relay of despair, so that sleepers 10 and 15 miles away were unknowingly disturbed by the boy's anguish, their last dreams of the morning being those of confinement or attempted escape. His mother writhed in agony in the sheets, her hands against her ears. Clara, in her small white room, sat straight up in her bed, then ran across the hall, down the stairs and out the front door before she knew she was awake. She circled the house until she found Tillman thrashing in the yard at the end of his chain, flecks of foam at the corner of his mouth. His eyes were unfocused. He didn't see her at all. "Stop it!" she screamed, flinging her body into his path, her fists pummeling flesh and the iron that encircled it. "You're bad," she sobbed. "You never stop being bad." Tillman stood still, panting and staring at his 10-year-old sister. "I've stopped," he said. And then her name. "Clara." Her feet were numb. The grass was crisp with frost, and the morning cold caused her teeth to chatter. Upstairs, in the sudden silence, the exhausted parents tumbled again into a deep well of sleep. He repeated her name. "Clara." As if he'd never said it before, as if she'd never heard it before. Every one of his ribs was bruised, the skin above them covered in plum-colored blossoms. When he pulled up his shirt to show this to his sister, it was as if he were exposing his heart. She winced and turned away. The color of the morning in these few moments had changed from gray to golden. Tillman pointed to the blacksmith's shed. "A hammer," he said. "Get me the hammer with the claw foot." And then her name again. "Clara." She loved her brother, loved his beautiful face, even when it was contorted by rage, by fear. She fetched the hammer, then looked at the squint of concentration around Tillman's eyes as he pried from the door the large bent nails that held his chain. He twisted away from her, leaping down the lane that led to the road. She returned to her room and stood at the window, watching her brother growing smaller and smaller in the distance, heading west with a newly risen sun on his back. May turned to June of 1914, and still Eamon stayed away from the Becker farm. Clara had been working every evening as long as the light lasted in order to finish a veil and a satin gown for her neighbor, Catherine Erb, a bride-to-be. Clara had almost decided to use a button with the twinned birds when she heard footsteps on the stairs. At first she thought it was her father, but it wasn't long before she identified the sound as unfamiliar, tentative. At least a minute passed before the person on the stairs began to ascend once more, and this time the footsteps were swift and purposeful. Clara knew who it was. She knew who it was. And yet this knowledge did nothing to abate the shock of seeing Eamon O'Sullivan standing on the threshold of her sunroom tailor shop. Characteristically, he said nothing. "It's been 6 weeks," she heard herself declare in exasperation. "6 weeks, and now what do you want?" He remained silent, staring at her from the doorway. Clara saw that small drops of sweat had beaded near his hairline. In the midst of his silence and his scrutiny, she felt the old anger returning, and she flushed and looked away from him. She dug her nails into her palm and counted to 10, not wanting to lose control. But it was too late, and she found herself confronting him with her scissors in her hand. "If you don't say something," she told him, "I'll stab you with these scissors. I mean it, Eamon." She didn't mean it, of course, but she was somewhat unnerved by how much she almost meant it. "I've come for a coat," he announced. The hand that held the scissors dropped to Clara's side. "Oh," she said, "the coat. It's hanging on a nail in the woodshed to the right of the door. But it isn't my jacket that I'm after. I want you to make a waistcoat for me."
"Do you?"
She found herself secretly pleased that he acknowledged her skill, aware of the necessary connection her sewing would make between them. He nodded, not looking at her. "I'll have to measure you," Clara said slowly, the horror of this now entering her mind. Then she looked him in the face with skepticism and said, "You don't have the money for it, do you?" He pulled a wad of bills out of his pocket, walked across the room, and flung the money on the table. "I've been working these 2 months at the brewery," he told her.
"The brewery,"
Clara repeated.
"Yes, and farming too."
Clara could not meet his gaze. "What color do you want then?" she asked.
"Red."
Clara had never made a red garment in her life. In fact, it was doubtful she had ever seen one, the costumes in her world being almost always black, white, or grey.
"Are you sure it's red you want?"
Clara asked dubiously.
"Red,"
Eamon said again, with great certainty. Clara sniffed, crossed the room to a set of shelves where she rummaged in a wooden box until she extracted a light brown measuring tape and a small black notebook. "I'll have to measure you," she repeated. "Stand up straight." Eamon squared his shoulders and thrust out his chin. Clara approached him. "The first measurement," she said, "is the neck." She placed the cool, flat tape on the back of his neck, drawing it together just over his Adam's apple. She could feel his breath brushing her cheekbone as he repeated the words, "The neck." Clara wrote the number of inches in the small book under the heading, "Red, waistcoat for silent Irish." "The next is the width of the chest at the shoulders," she measured and recorded the information. "Then the width of the chest from beneath the arms." She could hear his heart beating, and to her consternation, her own. "Turn around," she said. He turned. She pulled the tape across his shoulders, surprised at their width after the slenderness of his torso. They were facing each other again. Clara ran the tape down Eamon's arm. "Do you know," he asked, his voice breaking slightly, "do you know that your hands are like doves?" Clara cleared her throat. "The waist," she whispered, choosing to pretend she had not heard him, and thanking God silently she had never made trousers. "You," he said, "with your neck like a swan." In her mind, Clara ran out of the room, down the stairs, across the orchard and into the cedar woods. "I'll have to measure your hips," she said uncertainly, keeping her gaze directed at the floor. "I'll have to do that for the fit to be right." He seemed not to hear her. "I'll die of this," he told her. "These words about you running and running through my mind." She bent toward him, fixing her eyes on the dark printed numbers. "And me remaining silent for months and months, tasting the humiliation of knowing that once I spoke, you'd be gone from me like a startled bird." The panic in her was enough to make her wish for his old silence, her old impatience. Still, she straightened and looked into his face. Green eyes. "Do you never think of me?" he implored. "Never," Clara whispered. She was unaware that she still held the tape taut at the front of his body. "I'll die of this," he said, and kissed her on the mouth. Clara found that she was kissing him back, and the surprise caused her throat to constrict. She let the tape fall from his hips and brought her hands up to her face. "Why? Why must you have a red waistcoat?" she gasped, though it wasn't at all what she meant to say. Eamon drew quickly away, then began to pace back and forth across the room. "I'll leave the country," he declared, "and you'll not recall me for a moment. On you'll go with your life, sitting by another man's fire, while I'm an outcast moving from town to town, desperate at the very thought of you. I'll die in the winter ditch like a dog." He crossed the room and placed his hands on either side of her face. "But the waistcoat," she began. "Is for my funeral," he finished her sentence. "Make it well." Then he bolted from the room and thundered down the stairs, leaving Clara shaking as she attempted to write his measurements in her little black book. She lay awake all night, flat on her back, sweating under a quilt made from scraps of broadcloth and feathers stitched with scarlet embroidery thread. She remembered something. When they had been children, at the time when the whole village had been speaking of her brother's disappearance, Eamon had told Clara that he could help her send a message to Tilman if she wanted. She had followed the boy home from school and had gone with him into a plain brown shed. Suddenly she had been surrounded by the anxious movement and quavering noise of penned birds. "You write what you want to say on this piece of paper," he had said, producing a scrap from his pocket. "Then I'll tie it to a bird and send it off to Tilman." Clara prepared her message on the windowsill of the shed in the dim light. "Dear Tilman," she wrote with a pencil from her school bag, "please send me a letter with this bird." She knew better than to ask him to come home. Clara handed him the paper and watched as he rolled it up and fastened it to the bird's leg. Outside, the bird flew off into a cold winter sky. When she asked a few weeks later, Eamon told Clara that the bird had returned with the unanswered message still tied to its leg. She didn't know which boy to distrust more, the one who always went away, or the one who sent messages that could never be answered. When she dressed that morning, she stared at her body for the first time in a self-conscious way, as if it were somebody else's body altogether, the nipples hardening under her gaze. Then she put on her cotton summer clothes and a smock and left the house for her workshop. Once there, she circled the roughed-out form of the abbess for some time without once being moved to pick up the chisel. The thought of Eamon clung to her the way the wet nightgown had clung to her back, and it seemed that there had not yet been invented an exercise that would help her peel him off. Finally, in the heat of noon, she unrolled her pattern paper on the sunroom floor and began to map out the shapes Eamon's measurements suggested. All sounds were exaggerated by her exhaustion and her preoccupation. The crackle of the paper, the squeaking of the pencil as she pushed hard against it. Eventually, she lay on her stomach, her shoulders echoed by her drawing of his larger ones, her arms on the drawing of his sleeves, and fell asleep. When she awoke in mid-afternoon, and when she rolled up the large piece of brown paper, she was amazed to see that she had pushed the pencil so forcefully into the paper that the pattern she had drawn remained incised on the pine floor.
Episode 4 of The Stone Carvers, read by Nikki Guadagni. Next week, news of Father Justier's Corpus Christi procession attracts the attention of the local Orangemen, with surprising results. The novel is published by Viking Press. This reading was produced by Alison Moss. You can subscribe to this podcast at cbc.ca/podcasting.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.